All right, good evening. Welcome to Computer Science E76, Building Mobile Applications. My name is David Malin, and I will be one of your instructors this evening. Dan Armendariz is the other one. He will join us about halfway through tonight. He and I will both be back next week, and then for the most part, Dan will focus on the Android portion of the course, and I'll focus and return a few weeks later on the iOS portion of the course. So what are you in for this semester? So we think this is actually quite a bit of fun, this class, in as much as it's focused entirely on developing projects. Specifically in a mobile context. The arc of the course is such that we'll begin the semester looking at mobile web apps, applications written for mobile browsers, transitioning thereafter to Android apps, native apps specifically, and for the latest and greatest in Android devices, and then segue it toward semester's end toward the iOS platform. And along the way, you'll see things that are similar among these platforms, different among these platforms, and also get a sense, hopefully, of what you should be keeping in mind when deciding whether or not to deploy for X or Y or Z or some combination thereof. So along the way, we'll look at the standard tools for developing iOS apps, namely using tools like Eclipse and the SDK that Google provides, looking on the iOS world at Xcode, the SDK that Apple provides, and then the web stuff, tools are more freely available and open source, and we'll look at some of the tools with which you can build applications for not just Android and iOS, but really mobile platforms in general. So one of the distinctions we have already made is this idea of web apps versus native apps. And just to get things going, who would like to tease apart the differences between these two things, if you know? Sure.
One uses HTML, and like web apps use HTML, JavaScript, and other things.
Okay, good.
Versus a native app, which would run like native code on your cell phone, like directly on a metal.
Okay, perfect. So a web app is something written in HTML, JavaScript, CSS, technologies that we use in desktop environments, whereas native applications are actually written, in the context of this course, in Java, in the case of Android, in Objective-C, in the context of iOS, and the source code that you write on those platforms is compiled from source code down to object code, zeros and ones, that only those two particular platforms are meant to understand. So, okay, so that's the basic difference. Who cares? Why might you, as a developer, choose one over the other? Yeah?
Well, web apps could be cross-platform, right? If an app is native, it's going to run on Android or, let's say, iOS device, but web app could be a browser-based.
Okay, good. So something browser-based is more universally accessible, and as much as it only requires a browser, and there are, of course, browsers on Android devices, on iOS devices, on Windows Mobile devices, on BlackBerry devices. So that would seem to suggest that don't bother with native apps. Right? If the goal is to actually gain adoption of tools, to gain omnipresence, it would seem that native apps are just painting yourself into a corner. Yeah? Good. So native apps can typically access a wider array of functionality inside of the device. What's an example of one such feature, perhaps?
Accelerometer.
Yeah, so accelerometer, a device that can detect motion of the device. You can shake your phone as much as you want, but Safari or the Chrome browser WebKit is not going to detect that you're actually shaking your phone. Similarly, might you not have programmatic access to things like the gyroscope in the past, to things like the camera, and more of this functionality is now being exposed. But if you do need that full suite of capabilities, graphics in particular, the latest and greatest hardware acceleration, you're not necessarily going to get that in the context of a browser. What else might drive you toward writing a native app in Android or iOS? Yeah.
One thing would be that you have this built-in business model. Like once you get your app on the device, you have, you know, the Android store.
Yeah.
And the iOS store.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's kind of hard to sell a web app, right, if it's just at www.something.com. But, of course, native apps can be distributed through the Apple Store, through the Android Store, for which you have this built-in mechanism, even if these folks are taking a percentage. That's harder to do, at least, with the web. Yeah.
It's harder to follow a platform's look and feel if you're doing a web app.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. We'll look a bit at that today and next week. It's a little harder to at least mimic the device's look and feel, and if this is something that's important, and certainly in the Apple world, have they really tried to send a consistent message that they want everything to look similarly? Even in their Safari browser, has it always looked a little bit different from other browsers? So if you really want it to feel like a native app and not just look like some sort of chintzy little thing you threw together, native apps give you easier access to that kind of functionality.
Web apps need a connection.
Ah, so and this is maybe one of the biggest catches, and it probably should go without saying, a web app needs web access. And so even if it is the most useful tool around and is universally accessible across devices, if it requires an internet connection, you know, I don't even know if some of us could use it down here. All right, I switched to Verizon, so now I can. But last year when we ran the course and I was on AT&T, I wasn't doing any demos on this particular phone. So this is kind of a nail in the coffin, certainly for a large number of applications. So it's kind of a trade-off. And one of the motivations in this course for looking at this suite of various options is so that you can make that design decision for yourself. And also along the way, we'll discover that there are ways where you can kind of have the best of both worlds, whereby you can actually write native apps that can be deployed on multiple platforms by using one or more frameworks that exist. So Adobe has tried doing things like this. There's an open source one that Adobe has now purchased called PhoneGap, which is actually wonderfully compelling. And what this will boil down to, as we'll see later in the semester, is downloading some template code, some Objective-C code, some Java code for BlackBerry devices as well, that gives you a wrapper and gives you the framework for a native application. And then what's embedded inside of it is some kind of web-based browser. You don't see all of the Chrome around it and the back button and the forward button necessarily, but you have an embedded web browser. So on the one hand, you now have a product that you could distribute through the App Store. It gives the user the sense that this is something I downloaded and there's an icon by default on my screen. But, of course, the price you pay is that you do require, in that case, some kind of internet connection. But the upside here, too, there's one other upside of having things web-based and not downloadable and native. Yeah. Yeah, updates can pretty much be transparent to the user. I mean, even on my iPhone, I find it a little annoying that every week or so I have to download more updates for various programs. And if I don't do that, and I dare say many users don't bother or don't know how to update the applications, your bug fixes might not get pushed out, your new and greatest features might not get pushed out. So it's really a trade-off. And so by the end of the semester, you'll have a hands-on sense of how to implement these various kinds of applications, but also hopefully what kinds of judgment should go into picking among them. Any questions on the big picture of native versus web apps? Yeah?
Is there a middle ground? Is there something like a bytecode platform like the Java virtual machine on mobile devices?
Good question. Is there, and for those following along at home on camera, is there a middleman, a bytecode of sorts like Java that would work on all of them? At the moment, no. The closest you can get is through these frameworks like PhoneGap that let you essentially write your application once, deploy it multiple places, but even then, the core functionality is web-based, so you would still require the internet connection. And at least with the Java platforms, you could share more code in, say, the RIM world and the like, but then you have C# in the Windows Mobile world, so it's still a fairly contentious environment. All right, so some folks have made pretty good use of the mobile web. So MIT actually uses no frameworks for their mobile website. So this is m.mit.edu. You can pull it up on your phone, or this is a screenshot of a simulator that comes with the iOS SDK. And what they've done is essentially mimic the idea of a mobile application. The funny thing here is this is not really an application per se. It's just a web page. It really could be as simple as an index.html file, inside of which is a whole bunch of HTML tags, maybe some CSS, and just icons that someone made with Photoshop or the like that look just like they're perfectly sized for your finger. They're laid out in some kind of grid, but it's just a web page. And so one of the secrets behind mobile web development is that if you know how to develop for desktop browsers, you kind of already know how to develop for mobile devices. But there are going to be some gotchas. So beyond the mere formatting issues and the less screen real estate, there's a number of features you might want to leverage. For instance, if you do have your own Android device or iOS device, you might know that with most sites, you can rotate the device and hopefully the content will reshift around. You might notice that some sites let you pinch and zoom, but others don't. So there's actually a number of user interface issues that arise, for better or for worse. And frankly, I find it the most frustrating thing when you visit a website where you can't pinch and scroll because some person has decided to include one line of HTML that prohibits that for some reason. So we'll look at the relatively easy mechanisms whereby you can make for much better experience in this mobile context, and also how you can take advantage, nonetheless, of some of the fancier features of today's phone. So you might not be able to access the accelerometer, but you can access things like the the GPS capabilities of a device, whether using a GPS antenna or built-in Wi-Fi capabilities, and you can ask the browser, where is the user? And in fact, another advantage of some of these frameworks like PhoneGap is that because they are giving you some native code to compile and then deploy on a platform, but the code you write is actually meant to be web-based, they've actually wired things together for you in such a way that you can take advantage of more functionality, like the camera, like the address book, so you, in this hybrid model, can you do even a bit more than you might be able to do on a typical mobile website. So another little snippet here is one that you might use if you have a Gmail account. So Google's page. So this is a nice, it's simple, it fits perfectly on this particular phone, but it's just pure HTML. The CSS is designed to make it look a little sexier and a little more mobile friendly, but what they've done is somehow detected that I'm using a mobile device, instead of showing me the normal gmail.com, which would of course be a much bigger page, and then I'd have to pinch and scroll around to find the input field, they've simplified it. So that begs the question, if you do go to gmail.com or mit.edu, how do these websites know whether to or how to redirect you to something that's much more user-friendly for your device? The browser what? Okay, so the browser tells the sites. In what way does the browser tell the sites? Yeah?
Is it encoded in the GET request?
Okay, does it encode it in the GET request? So we'll look at this in more detail next week, but for now, a GET request, just for those unfamiliar, is one that would typically go through only via the URL. It's not a POST operation, and so the amount of data you can send is relatively more limited, and the privacy of the information you might transmit is a little less in as much as it shows up in the URL. So with that quick definition, does it show up in the GET string? No, is the short answer there. But there is a similar mechanism in place. Yeah, so there's also these HTTP headers that in addition to the message getmefoo.html, every browser, unbeknownst to you perhaps, sends things like the type of browser that you're using, the operating system that you're using, and the first of those is the most germane. And it's not a requirement that browsers send this information, but by default, almost every browser does do this, unless you have some privacy blocking software that's trying to hide these details. So with fairly high probability, a web server, upon getting a request via a web browser and sees that, oh, this is for Safari, or this is for mobile Safari, it can decide whether or not to show it the big version or the small version. And by showing it big or small, it can just literally show the smaller version, the version that's formatted a little more compactly for the site, or what a lot of sites do is redirect the users to something like m.whatever.com. And here too is another user experience problem that a lot of websites seem to suffer from, especially ones that have seemed, for me at least, to be linked through Google News all the time. There's nothing more frustrating, I think, than to go to like Google News or some blog that's linking to articles. You click the article, and then you do get redirected to m.whatever.com, but that's where you get redirected. And whatever deep link you were trying to follow, whatever article you were trying to follow, you have to now go re-find it. And this is just inane, to be honest. And we'll see in the course that these are such simple things to fix. Again, in that case, we're talking one line of code. And so being mindful of these things, frankly, can continue, I dare say, to drive traffic back to your site. So if the user clicks a link, they get where they intend to go. So we'll look at some of those HTTP and HTML-based mechanisms. All right, so besides this, you then have the native app. So if you buy an iPhone, you buy an Android device, you typically get a bunch of functionality for free. And of course, the App Store provides you with some additional functionality. And so that's when you get these icons on the screen. But just to toss it out there, is it necessary to write and go through the process of writing a native app just if your goal is to have that touchable icon on the screen? Okay, so kind of a leading question. So the short answer is no, right? If unfamiliar, at least on an iOS device as well as on Android, you can click an appropriate button when visiting a web page with the built-in browser and then say the equivalent of add bookmark to home screen. Now, do your less technical family and friends know how to do this? You know, probably not. And even I never actually do this. So at least right now, 2012, there's still, I would say, this cachet of having a native app that you can download, whether for money or for free, that definitely appeals to a lot of developers because it seems to make it a little more special than some random website you can go to and I can bookmark it, even though the end result is pretty consistent with the behavior of a lot of web apps. So we'll see how you can implement, again, either of those types of approaches. With Android, I'll defer largely to my colleague, Dan, and we'll dive into mostly today web-oriented stuff, but over the next several weeks, we'll dive into the Android platform in particular. So what does it take to make a mobile website, and what are some of the things to be mindful of now that we're talking fairly limited devices? They're getting better and at a remarkable pace, but they tend to have less RAM, they tend to have slower CPUs, they tend to have smaller screens. So what are the things we need to be mindful of when designing? So here's perhaps the simplest of HTML5 web pages. It's got a head, it's got a body, it's got the much simplified doc type. And what's nice about the mobile browsers these days is they pretty much do conform to and support some of these latest and greatest standards, particularly those based on the WebKit browser, which is an open source browser on which Safari, Chrome, and some other smaller players are based on. So here's a very simple page, but suppose now we actually add something very reasonable, like a couple of tags for a style sheet in CSS and some JavaScript code in a JS file. So because we've now linked to these two separate files, we're sort of adhering to some good practices because now those files can be cached and I don't have to copy and paste the same JavaScript code and CSS in all of my files. So sort of, you know, basic factoring out of code, in this case CSS and JavaScript. But I am paying a price now for this cleaner design, particularly in the mobile space. What's now a downside or the price I pay for, you know, adhering to these decent practices?
Memory.
So memory in what sense?
Well, you've got these files that are stored in memory and you've only got limited memory to work with, so
okay.
It slows down your processing.
Okay, so these files are just sometimes of non-trivial size, a few kilobytes. They're going to be saved in memory, ideally, in some kind of cache, so you're consuming that memory. I would push back a little bit and say that, yes, they are going to take up some space, but the browser can still evict them from memory when it does need to reclaim that RAM. Yeah?
It's more calls that the computer has to do. So let's say if you have like 5 or 6 file sheets, it's really going to start to slow down.
Yeah, this is one of the real gotchas to be mindful of, at least in a mobile context, is that the latency of network connections on a mobile device, at least right now, is still much, much higher on people's broadband connections. If you sort of think back to the days when you or your friends had dial-up versus broadband, I mean, we're kind of back at that disparity, maybe not to the same extent, but whereby if you pull up a web page on a browser, it tends to do more thinking. And that's in part because of the processor, might be slower than the 2 or 3 gigahertz machine you have on your desk with multiple gigs of RAM. But also, there are longer round-trip times because you're on a 3G connection or an Edge or GPRS connection or the like. So each of these network requests for files might very well take a few more milliseconds or worse, a few more seconds. So in this case here, just like in the desktop world, the browser goes to this page, downloads the HTML, and realizes top to bottom, oh, I've got to recursively go fetch some additional content. And so I see the first yellow line there, and it makes a second HTTP request for styles.css. Then it gets to the JavaScript tag and goes for a third HTTP request for scripts.js. And for those who have spent a while in the desktop web web publishing space, you might know that if either of those files, whether hosted by you or others, are pointing to servers that are down or simply slow, if you designed your site in a certain suboptimal way, these tags can actually hang the entire loading of a web page, especially if you have even more such stuff down in the body in inappropriate places, which is incredibly common among advertisers putting div tags, span tags, and rather script tags and such in sort of bad places, anywhere really other than the bottom of the page. So one, the user might just see a spinning icon and a white screen for quite some time, and then just as a matter of logic, it's just going to take more time if you have yet more content to download. So how do you mitigate these things? Well, on the one hand, you could just kind of regress and just say, all right, well, if I want to minimize HTTP requests, why don't I just go copy and paste from styles.css everything inside of a style tag? And same for the script tag there. Go copy and paste script.js, paste it in here, bam, down to one HTTP request, which would seem to be the theoretical minimum. Downside? Yeah. Okay, so now more caching, right? There's more bits that are going to be consumed when you actually cache these files. Another downside? Yeah.
Every page you go to, you're going to have to include all that.
Yeah.
Load it every single time.
Exactly. So the caching that you were benefiting from in terms of subsequent page requests, you've now sacrificed completely because your, let's say, 5 kilobyte file has now mushroomed to 20 kilobytes, or even worse, if you're using something like jQuery in your site, which are fairly large file downloads. So while this might be reasonable for the smallest of sites, for which you don't have a huge number of bits to be downloaded, it's probably not a net positive, certainly after the first file has been downloaded, if you have to do it again and again. So what else might you do? Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. What's the other problem?
The other problem is if you're as a developer and you want to change something about the look and feel of your site, you'd have to do it on every page to keep it consistent.
Exactly. So you also sacrifice some of the most compelling features of this factoring out of code, of being able to edit it now in one place, whether it's CSS, JavaScript, or the like. So what can we do? Well, there's a few approaches, and this is where it gets both fun and also a little annoying, frankly, right now, to have to solve these kinds of problems. But Google, at the URL down here, and all of these slides will be linked after tonight on the course's website, Google had a really interesting blog post from when they were rolling out mobile Gmail. So not the native app that they recently rolled out on iOS, but the web-based app that's actually quite good. And so they discuss some of the tricks that they used. And these tricks are ultimately based on sort of fundamentals of HTTP and how browsers work. And this was one snippet of code that they proposed, whereby if the problem you want to solve is downloading, after the initial index.html, more content, whether for CSS or JavaScript, the latter in particular, how can you go about getting that data asynchronously? So after the main content is downloaded, and ideally the page has at least rendered, even if it's not fully functional, maybe we can at least improve the user experience by approximating or creating the illusion of responsiveness, even if we can't quite do everything the user wants yet. And so here, if familiar with JavaScript, and next week we'll spend even more time on JavaScript, we have the definition of a function here called loadFile. It takes an argument called URL, and then I have just 3 lines of code. I declare a variable called script, and I call document.createElement, quote unquote, script, and that does what it says. It creates a DOM element, document object model, so to speak, called script. And it stores inside of the source attribute of that DOM element, the URL that you've been passed in as an argument. And then down here, it appends to the existing page's DOM, so the existing index.html that already downloaded, at the bottom of its head tag, that script tag. And what browsers do is they're smart enough to realize that if you insert an additional DOM node into the tree that represents an HTML page, and it happens to be a script tag, and it happens to have a source attribute, it will then proceed to go and download that file. So in this case, you can immediately show the user whatever simple page you want to show them. And on a mobile device, you don't need all that much HTML to at least fill a screen. And then you can asynchronously, that is after the fact, without blocking the loading of the first page, go and get some additional content, simply by understanding the nature and construction of a DOM. Now, you can do things that are a little fancier. Those of you who've spent some time in this space in recent years know that Ajax certainly is all the rage, whereby Ajax is a technique involving JavaScript, whereby you can, after loading a page, make additional HTTP requests from browser to server without reloading the whole page. So this is how almost any popular website these days creates the illusion of dynamism and automatic updates, Gmail, Facebook, and others among them. So we could leverage this same idea, not sort of implement that hackish approach before, and we can do something like this. So this is a snippet of code that, again, starts with the declaration of load file URL. Here we seem to be declaring a function, which is going to be called callback arbitrarily. And here we have something like if request.readyState equals equals 4 and the request.status equals equals 200, then eval this property called response text. So if unfamiliar as of now with some of the inner workings of Ajax, this just means if the Ajax request has come back from server to client, and the response was 200, which means good, whereas 404, 403, 401, 500 are all bad. That just means go ahead and evaluate whatever the response was. Now, what might the response be? Well, let's see what code is actually being executed down here. So this is how Ajax, at least on most browsers, is implemented with this special XML HTTP object, a request object. I'm specifying in line 2 here that when the state has changed, essentially, call this function. So in other words, an AJAX object can pass through several states. You've opened a connection, you've sent a connection, you're waiting for a connection, you've got a response back, you've finished parsing the response. So hence the number 4, that refers to stage 4, the loaded stage in that case. So call this function whenever anything changes. And the only thing I care about, apparently, is when I finally get to the loaded stage. I'm going to ignore stages 1 through 3. What I'm going to do after assigning this event handler to this property is I'm going to say open via get this URL, and true here just means asynchronous. In other words, don't hang here for some number of milliseconds or seconds synchronously. Instead, return immediately and invoke this pre-configured function when the response comes back from the server, however many seconds later. And then finally send with no data because it's a get, so we don't need to actually send anything other than the actual URL. So in this case, what is going to be in the server's response? Well, per this particular discussion on Google's blog, this might just be more JavaScript code or more CSS or more of something that they then want to proceed to evaluate. And so this is another, perhaps more clean or more modern approach to that same idea. So this isn't to say that the very first time you roll out some mobile website that you have to now all of a sudden start jumping through all of these hoops. But it's definitely when it comes time to think about performance, especially if you can't assume good network connections, whether it's because folks are on slower phones or international users connecting all the way here with very high latency to the US, keeping these kinds of techniques in mind can certainly help you improve that experience marginally. Yeah. How about preloading those files in application startup? Absolutely. You could also do something like that. This has been a common technique with images, for instance, with websites. So similarly, could you do something like that? In this case, they're loaded on demand or can be loaded on demand, which is perhaps a compelling feature, especially if you're not going to touch certain icons on the screen necessarily. All right. So how can we take web applications, how can we stand on the shoulders of others in order to build the interesting part of web applications, mobile web applications, without having to implement all of the smallest nitty-gritty details ourselves, the buttons, the icons, the fancy transitions and overlays that are possible so easily, it seems, with Android and iOS devices? Well, we can mimic a lot of that same sexy behavior even in mobile web apps, but we can generally do this much more quickly by leveraging some existing tools. So among the most popular these days, jQuery Mobile, which as of this year finally achieved 1.0 status, which is to say that it's pretty mature and it plays very nicely by nature with jQuery. If unfamiliar with jQuery, we will encourage it. We'll use it in some examples. And you'll find that especially in the mobile context where you're making most likely a number of AJAX calls, it simplifies a lot of things. And the jQuery Mobile library is meant to provide you with some very nice user interface widgets so that you have nice buttons and icons and the means of making something that, you know, looks pretty similar to a native app, even though it actually is not. PhoneGap is the framework to which I alluded earlier that allows you to actually ship native applications, but by wrapping an embedded browser in them for all sorts of platforms, not just Android and iOS, but also BlackBerry, Windows Mobile, and a few others as well. Sentia Touch is in the same bucket as jQuery Mobile, which is a JavaScript library that makes it easier to develop mobile web applications with all the bells and whistles that you might want in a desktop browser, like select menus and drop-downs and buttons and toggles and the like. The learning curve, I would say, for Sentia Touch is higher, and you end up writing much more code typically, but it does have some nice capabilities that not all of these libraries tend to have. So what you'll find for the first project in the course, you'll be encouraged, not required to use one in particular, but encouraged to try adopting one of these and integrating it into your own code so that you really have a really nice product that's polished without having to do everything from scratch, as in the case, for instance, of MIT's website, which is actually devoid of a lot of the sort of fancy transitions that folks are just getting used to, at least in a mobile context. Just to give an example, I'm going to go ahead here and let me open up a program called iOS Simulator. This is a program that comes with Xcode, which you get when downloading the SDK for iOS development, which we'll get to mid-semester. So I'm going to go ahead and just click the Safari button here. And this was an application that we simply used recently for an event at Harvard that had a whole bunch of folks attending from across campus to see. Let me go back to Let me delete everything up to the tag there. All right, so this is indeed just a mobile web application, but what we tried to do is at least give it the appearance of a full-fledged web app, but we didn't want attendees at this particular event, which was like a science fair for folks to attend and see people's projects. We wanted to have a few buttons at top, so at the top left here, we have a little map, and if you click this, you can actually see a little map that appears there. You can click on projects, and now you can see a list sort of formatted reminiscently of Android's and iOS's standard approaches. It's not, admittedly, nearly as clean as a native device. In fact, you might have seen the flicker on the previous screen that it actually reloaded the menu bar. So you'll actually find that you can't quite do everything perfectly. I can't hit the back button here, and it does seem to scroll like this, but if I go here, this isn't quite the same effect. It's zooming in from the middle. Now, you can use other transitions, but this is to suggest that this took us a few hours at night. In fact, Tommy McWilliam, who you'll meet in a bit, the course's head teaching fellow, threw this together in a night. So it's pretty compelling what you can do relatively quickly that looks pretty good, but it definitely doesn't have the polish that a lot of these native applications have. So it really depends ultimately on what your objectives are. So that is using the jQuery mobile library for JavaScript. All right, any questions on this high level? So let's take a quick look structurally at the course and expectations, loop back then at a teaser for what's to come, at least on the iOS and also HTML5 half of the world, and then we'll introduce some of my colleagues here. So expectations for the course, as stated in the syllabus, which you should have a printout of from tonight, it's also available, as with all other handouts in the future on the course's website, is to attend or watch all lectures and sections, more in a moment on what sections are, and submit all projects, more in a moment on what projects are, no exams or midterms or the like. In terms of prerequisites, so officially on the books is Computer Science E52, which is the Extension School's Intensive Introduction to Computer Science. It's not so much the particulars of that class that are expected, but the rigor and experience that would typically be correlated with taking that or a similar class. Ideally, you'd be coming into this class with specifically that one under your belt, or I would say a couple of semesters of other computer science classes, or one or more courses in object-oriented programming in particular, in languages like Java, C#, PHP, if you've used the OOP features of it. It doesn't matter so much to us the language, but really the sophistication that tends to come with that kind of experience, so that when we talk about classes and constructors and objects, instantiation, hierarchy, these kinds of words that tend to surround topics in object-oriented programming, that stuff's not new to you. But rather, the focus of the course is what's new, these various platforms, some of the SDKs, some of the ideas underlying these mobile platforms. So what you can do, if you're among those who are on the fence, not quite sure if your background is sufficient, definitely after tonight come up and chat with me or Dan or Tommy. But also if you go to cs76.tv, you'll see last year's version of the course with the PDFs of projects, with videos of all lectures and sections and the like. So if you'd like a litmus test of what the course was like and will likely be like this year, that might be a more effective answer than we could give verbally alone, because you'll actually see what's on the horizon. So that is cs76.tv. In terms of lectures, one more prerequisite. This is an annoying one. Access to an Intel-based Mac running Lion. Unfortunately, this is sort of the way things are on that half of the world. Whereas for Android, you can use a Mac, PC, Linux box, whatever, so long as it has a Java runtime environment and compiler on it, and you have access to something like Eclipse, and they can therefore download Google's SDK. Unfortunately, Apple prefers that you play in their world. And so for this, unfortunately, you need, ideally, a relatively new Mac that does have Lion on it. If you're still running Leopard or Snow Leopard, now would be an ideal time to upgrade if you are willing. It tends, unfortunately, to be $30, but that's cheaper than a new computer. With that said, Lion is not strictly necessary. If you still have Snow Leopard and for work or personal preferences really don't want to upgrade to Lion, you can download the latest version of Xcode, which happens to be 4.2, But it's $99 because you have to sign up for Apple's official developer program. And we'll walk you through these steps later in the course if of interest to you in signing up for these development programs. So it's either upgrade to Lion for $30 and get the software for free, or don't upgrade to Lion for $99 and get the software for free in that case. So it's really up to you, and feel free to reach out to us in person or email if you're unsure what side of the which direction to go. There will be Macs on campus at 53 Church Street, which is the computer lab in Harvard Square of the Extension Schools that has kindly installed Xcode for us and the like. So you're welcome to use that. The hours of operation can be found at lab.dce.harvard.edu, as well as linked, I believe, in the course's syllabus. But the gotcha there is that you have to be on campus physically. So any questions on prerequisites? And you can certainly ask more privately later, too.
But you need to pay the developer fee anyways to get your digital signature, don't you?
If you do want to submit applications to the store, yes, you will need to pay the $99 personal developer fee or $199 fee for a company. For the course's purposes, we have a university account that we can add people's iOS devices to so that you can install software that you write on your iPads, iPhones, and iPods without paying anything. The gotcha is if you want to deploy that same code to friends' devices or to the store itself, then you have to decouple yourself from the course and invest in one of those programs. So it's ultimately up to you. And this, too, is you wouldn't think this would be the case, but to install software you write on the phone you bought, you have to pay Apple. You can't just do it for free. So, lectures. So tonight is our first of two HTML5-centric lectures. We'll have five on Android, five on iOS, and projects accompanying each. More on those in just a moment. But before we do, let me introduce en masse the course's teaching staff here, a couple of whom are with us here tonight. And let me in particular draw our attention to Tommy McWilliam, if you'd like to come up and say hello, Tommy. And then all of us will stick around after class if you'd like to ask a few questions.
Hi there. So I'm Tommy. I'll be the course's head chef for the semester. I'm really looking forward to a great semester. I think you're going to have a lot of fun making both Android and iOS apps. Any questions about the course, prereqs, or what sections are, which are basically just more intimate settings where you can, you and 20 or so of your classmates can be with the teaching fellow, myself and the staff listed here. You can ask questions and interact in a more hands-on basis than lectures. But any other logistical questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. And a few of us will linger up here up front afterwards so as to strike up chats. We have among the staff are several former students as well who can speak to that their own experience with that. So the course's website will be at cs76.net. Everything will be there, including videos of lectures, including handouts, including links to software and such. At help.cs76.net will be an online bulletin board system of sorts via which you can get help throughout the semester, reaching out both to classmates as well as to the course's staff. Do, before the first project submission, take care to review the course's syllabus, which addresses matters of academic honesty and where the line is between sharing and oversharing in a forum like that. But for the most part, that system exists so that we and you can intercommunicate throughout the term. Projects. So what's on the horizon? So you'll find that there are a collection of projects throughout the term, the first of which is dubbed Mobile Local, which is linked actually on the course's website right now. For Mobile Local, will you implement your own mobile web application that integrates HTML with CSS, with JavaScript, with one or more potentially libraries of your choice that allows a user to, one, take out their phone, visit this site, and be asked, where are you? And using the geolocation capabilities of HTML5 to pinpoint their GPS coordinates, convert those to a latitude, longitude, and or city state, so as to then pull dynamically news from that local area and weather from that local area using a number of online freely available resources. Along the way, you'll potentially trip over some issues, among which is something called the same origin policy. This refers to, which you might be familiar in the desktop world, to the constraint that typically a web browser with some JavaScript code in a web page can only request additional data from the same server that that page originally came from. So if you visit foo.com, any JavaScript code on that page should really only be allowed to access more stuff from foo.com. If you try to make an AJAX query typically from a foo.com webpage to bar.com, you're going to get some kind of access denied. And the data is not, in fact, going to come back and be integratable into your DOM as would be typically possible with AJAX. So there's a number of ways of working around this, one of which is an extension that requires tweaking your web server a little bit and changing the HTTP headers. But another one is to use a proxy of sorts, which you yourselves could implement. But the course's focus will be largely client-side, not so much server-side, so that then you don't have to implement your own PHP or Python or Ruby or C# or whatever backend, just to proxy publicly available information like news and weather back through your own server. You'll be introduced in this project to something called YQL, Yahoo Query Language, which is representative of, quite simply, a proxying service. And what you'll see, and the specification online will walk you through this process, you can provide Yahoo with the URL from, say, Google News to get some news from any weather service that you might find. And so long as that weather service or news service syndicates information in something machine readable, like JSON or RSS or XML more generally, you can have Yahoo fetch that data on your behalf and then wrap it with something called JSONP, padded JSON. And what JSONP allows you to do is essentially circumvent this the same origin policy, because rather than get back from Yahoo just a big JSON blob, and for those unfamiliar with JSON, rest assured we'll get there before long, a JSONP object is one that has a chunk of information, but to the left of it is the word foo, which is a function call, then an open parenthesis, then your data, then a close parenthesis. So via this technique known as padded JSON, you can induce a browser to execute, sort of in the spirit of eval, but a little less scarily, a chunk of data that's been returned to you from some server. And so you'll be introduced in this and future projects to some of these options that exist that allow you to solve some of these problems certainly more quickly than you might be able to if doing it on your own, and also by punting to some fairly reputable third-party services that, if you're comfortable relying on, definitely expedite development. Now, in the Android world, you'll dive into a trio of Android projects, the first of which will be simply a setup project where we, via a PDF, will walk you through the process of downloading the tools that you need and the software that you need, all of which is freely available in this case. You'll then dive into a staff's choice of projects, whereby we will assign through a specification an application that everyone must then arise to the challenge of and implement, but many of the design decisions will be left to you so that you can enjoy the process of not only designing what's underneath the hood, but also the aesthetics and user interface of your site. And then there will be a student's choice project for Android, which means you will propose to us something that you would love to work on. We will then just be a sounding board, sanity check, this is too much, this is too little, so that you'll culminate the Android portion of the course by developing your very own Android application. And then we'll repeat that process in the iOS world, a bit of a setup project that'll walk you through the process of signing up for whatever you need for Apple, downloading the requisite software, getting a little Hello World app together. Then we'll transition to a staff's choice of projects where you'll be prescribed a goal that everyone is to achieve, and then you'll have an opportunity to propose and implement your own a project of your own design, so that by term's end, you have not only some number of course-assigned projects, but also some of your own works of art that you can then share with classmates. In terms of grades, we evaluate projects as coarsely as possible, since in many of those cases we're really comparing apples and oranges. And so the axes that we rely upon are scope. How much of the specification have you actually implemented? And this really should boil down to checking off boxes, making sure you've achieved certain functionality. Correctness, though, does it actually behave in a manner consistent with our specification, or in the case of the student's choice projects, when I click this button, does it actually do what you proposed that it would do? Or are there ways I can break your site or application just by providing bogus input? Design. This is the more subjective of those three. How well implemented is it underneath the hood? Do you have innumerably nested for loops? Do you have a horrific design, even though it might work? And so having a conversation with us ultimately through feedback on the design of software, on the design of your software, will be the other axis along which we evaluate. And then style. And style should be the easiest of them, dare say. Are your variables aptly named? Have you indented nicely so that your code is readable? Is everything nicely commented and such? And so this will be the fourth of those axes. And typically these axes are weighted in that descending order, where scope would be weighted more heavily, correct followed by correctness, and as much as those typically constitute the bulk of the time invested in a project, whereas style is worth a little less, but is also a silly thing to sacrifice in the name of time if you exercise best practices as you go. In addition to these lectures, we have what are called sections, aka recitations. These will be opportunities each week to meet in a more intimate environment with just some of the classmates and the teaching fellows present to work through additional examples, to discuss material that's arisen in that week or prior week's lectures, and generally to ask even more Q&A. Office hours, too, will follow those sections so that if you have a question about something that's really been confusing you and lectures and sections just aren't helping you make those connections, we can chat more intimately one-on-one, as well as projects themselves. If you're trying to chase down some issue, have design questions, aren't sure how to approach something, office hours, which will, again, follow sections each week, will just be an opportunity for more casual Q&A. So you're welcome and encouraged to bring your laptops. If you do have your laptop and haven't gotten onto Harvard's network, we can help you during the break today, or there are, ironically, instructions on the course's website under FAQs for how to get on the network, so at least preemptively next week. So we won't have sections and office hours tonight other than casual Q&A for folks who have questions about the course, but in general, they'll be right after lecture so that you can commute just once during the week for those. But on occasional weeks, for the staff choice of projects, we'll have what are called walkthroughs. So there'll be three of these for the HTML5, the Android, and the iOS staff's choice, and these will be led by Tommy and be opportunities to be walked through the specification for that week, so that even though you'll find that the specs are fairly detailed, at least, especially if you're a little less comfortable with this material, you're a little more new to this world of programming, you will have an opportunity really to be guided through and advised on where to begin and how you might begin. So these will be optional and filmed and will generally happen on Wednesdays, so that once the specs have been released and the week's material introduced, you'll have a couple days to read through, absorb the spec, decide what you might have questions on, and then join us a second time that week. And the course will culminate in what we've dubbed an apt party. So this will be an opportunity both for local students and even those of you farther away, if you'd like to join us with family and friends on campus on Friday, May 4th, at the end of the day, for a gathering in the computer science building where ideally everyone will bring their mobile device and or laptop and simulators and such, and show off to classmates and any fellow attendees and family members what they have accomplished during the term, both the staff's choice but particularly the student choices of projects, which are uniquely your own. And there will be cake, so if that wasn't enough. Any questions? All right, so just a quick teaser then of what's to come in the iOS space. And this will, again, recur roughly halfway, two-thirds of the way through the semester. So before long, on your own Mac, on a lab Mac, on a friend's Mac, will you need this tool called Xcode. The latest version, again, is 4.2. And Xcode comes with a suite of tools that will allow you, in a nice user-friendly graphical environment, to write code, specifically Objective-C, that can be compiled for iOS devices, among them the iPod Touch, iPhone, and iPad. With this also comes a number of other tools, like an instruments tool, so that you can actually assess the quality of your code's performance. Do you have hotspots? Do you have lots of loops that are creating or that are consuming CPU cycles, perhaps unnecessarily? Do you have memory leaks that you're trying to chase down? Do you have other performance issues? It comes with a number of nice tools for doing so. Interface Builder, this refers to something that's now built into Xcode that allows you to wire things together in a manner that I'll do in just a moment as a simple teaser. But what's nice about these development environments is that you don't necessarily have to write everything from scratch in actual source code. There is a drag and drop portion to these IDEs that are getting increasingly better, but they can also get in the way sometimes. And so we'll see over the course of the semester how to do things the drag and drop way and then write code that interconnects everything in the way you want it, or simply doing everything with raw code. You can go in both directions. And the iOS reference library is simply documentation that would come with this. And let me mention this. We do have a number of recommended books on the course's syllabus. But they really are just recommended in that they're almost out of date already. This is in part because this is a very quickly moving space, both on the Android side and the iOS side. And so I mention this now simply to beware if you go and pick up some other book off the shelf. Xcode 4.2 is several months old now, but I don't doubt that there's plenty of books online and in bookstores still that cover earlier versions of the SDK. So the SDK is up to version 5. iOS 5 is the latest and greatest on people's devices, and it does have some compelling new language features. So curiously, Xcode is still numbered 4.2. So that's the latest Xcode version for iOS 5. So just beware, if picking up a book, whether new or used, that it's at least consistent, because one of the most annoying things over the past 3 or 4 years has been just the speed at which things are changing, and books get outdated within months sometimes. So realize there's plenty of online resources available of varying quality and varying up-to-datedness, but we'll help guide you through those by pointing you at some canonical references on the course's website. So what kinds of functionality will you have opportunities to play with? We'll focus as much as possible on the fundamentals underlying these two platforms, as well as mobile web development, and focus less on things like here's how to embed a map, and here's how to create an ad, or here's how to integrate with the address book, so that instead you can parlay the fundamentals and the examples that we'll use throughout the course into these very more specific uses of frameworks. But you'll find that as we discuss the language, namely Objective-C and the overarching framework that is iOS, that all of these things are relatively easy to pick up once you know how to navigate the documentation and you understand how to construct programs using this framework. So a little demo is something we can whip up here. I'm going to go ahead and load Xcode. And we'll discuss this in much more detail as to what you're getting here, because admittedly, Xcode, while at first glance looks nice and simple, it looks practically like iTunes, and it's that simple, as we'll see in a moment, to run code. It's just because they've hidden a lot of the complexity under submenus and the like, and what we're seeing here is simply, much like a lot of tools have, like Word and Excel, just standard templates that you can start with, all of whose code you can rip out. But one of the harder things, at least for me early on, with picking up iOS development is just how many details Apple initially hides by default. So wrapping your mind around a lot of the inner workings can take some time, but we'll do our best to navigate all of that. In this case, I just want a single view application, which pretty much means something simple. So I'm going to go ahead and click Next. I'm going to give this a name like Hello. I'm going to leave everything else at default. I'm going to save it wherever. And what I now have is this IDE environment. And I'm going to ignore most of these links. And I'm going to see if I can't actually read this over there. Is this the one? This is the one I want. So this is what's called a nib file, and this is what I alluded to earlier using the phrase interface builder. You can build interfaces with this particular integrated tool. I'm going to go ahead here and drag something familiar over here, label. Let's see, I'll get it nice and centered. I'm going to go ahead and say hello world. Now I'm going to go here. And now, all it's going to take is, let me choose the simulator. I want the iPhone simulator, not the iPad. I'm going to click play. And you will see, 5 weeks from now, 6 weeks from now, you too will be able to make an iPhone application. So with that said, why don't we pause here, take a 5-minute break, and we'll be rejoined by my colleague Dan Armendariz, and we'll take a look at the Android and web half of the class.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dan Armendariz. I'm the other co-lecturer for Computer Science E76, and I'll be talking about, as we come up to it in a couple of weeks, the Android stuff in particular, and also in the next couple of lectures, we'll talk about some HTML5 stuff, and just some generic HTML5 stuff today, and then maybe a little bit, if we get a chance, to talk about some of the really exciting and interesting stuff that really comes up with HTML5, including local storage, and next week we will continue to cover more of that and some geolocation stuff, and that using this technology is actually something that can really make a very fun web application very quickly, and it's sort of an interesting thing because we're going to show a small demo next week of a kind of a an interesting slash creepy little GPS tracker app that you can create with as a web application. It's something that we can do actually in a couple of hours in lecture, as you'll actually see as we go through iteratively each of the steps as we create this web app. And it's something that even though it'd be very easy to do using web application, it actually will take us much longer to do as a native app, just as you'll find out for a variety of reasons throughout the semester. But before we do that, I actually want to introduce yet another member of our staff who's actually been with us since the beginning. So this course is now the second time, or rather, I suppose, the third time that this actual implementation has been offered. But there was a version of this course way back in the spring of 2010 that was offered with, if you could believe it, a wait list limit of about 30 people, or an enrollment limit of 30 people. So if you're on the wait list right now and you think it's bad that only 120-something people are being allowed in, just imagine back in 2010 when it filled up very quickly. But anyway, JP was actually a student here, and he's now a TF. For this class now, and so he's actually a good resource as well for a lot of questions that you may have, because he's seen the development of not only the class but also the resources and all of the technologies that are in use and that we are actually going to be talking about coming up soon. Before we start talking a little bit about some HTML5 stuff, I do want to mention a quick few things as introduction regarding the Android portion as well. So keep in mind that even though we're going to be talking about two very different platforms, everything, in fact, is actually going to remain as different as you can possibly imagine. So even though for iOS we'll talk about Xcode and Objective-C as the programming language, Android is, in fact, a completely different beast. And every year we tend to get questions from people saying, well, I really don't want to have to learn two different IDEs. Is it at all possible for me to use just one of them for both? The answer I'm going to tell you right now is no way. There's no way that you can use either Eclipse or Xcode for both of these things. So unfortunately, you're just going to have to buckle down, get used to both of these very different styles of programming for these specific platforms. And so with Android, we're actually going to be referencing this website a lot, developer.android.com. Starting in a couple of weeks, it's actually going to be the best resource for you to be able to find out how you can perform certain things. It's going to have a very good API website where you can look up specific APIs for things that you might want to do. It's something that we're going to reference a lot, and you'll see us have a lot of links and references to that specific web page. Now, Android, of course, runs a modified version of the Linux platform, and so it's been optimized for low memory and to be a little bit faster, perhaps, on these smaller devices. But it does, in fact, use, while we will be using the Eclipse IDE, and we will be using Java, or a version of Java for the code. And by a version of Java, I mean we're not actually using Java in the traditional sense, where you write Java code and then you compile using a Java compiler. That is sort of true. You are actually still using Java code, but there's a very important distinction in that there's a further step that converts that Java bytecode into something different that is actually being used by the Android platform. And so if you actually poke around a little bit in the developer page of the Android website, one of the things that you'll notice is that there's actually two different development kits. There's an SDK, or software development kit, and an NDK, or native development kit. And really, we're not going to touch the NDK at all. It's much more lower level. It's something that you might use if you were going to create a game, for example, or more specifically, a game that requires full use of the CPU, and it's going to be very graphics intensive. And it's because it's much lower level, it's not something that we're going to get a chance to get to. But instead, what we'll talk about throughout this class is instead the SDK, which does use Java, and it is, in fact, something that we'll become a little bit more familiar with over time. So I mentioned before that it uses a version modified version of Linux, and it does, in fact, run not a Java virtual machine in order to run this Java application, but it uses something else called a Dalvik virtual machine. And the Dalvik virtual machine is distinct from the Java virtual machine in that it's designed to be much lower memory, and it's designed for a variety of other things that we'll talk more about in the upcoming weeks. And so that's actually the primary reason why we, when we write native Android applications where we will be using the Java language, but we're not actually going to be compiling Java programs. We will actually be compiling into Java programs and then converting them into this Dalvik language or this Dalvik bytecode that's then packaged into an Android package. So luckily, Eclipse takes all of these steps and it makes it easy for us to do it. It's actually possible to program Android applications without using an IDE. You can actually write it in your text editor of choice, like, I don't know, TextEdit or Notepad or Vim or what have you. And then you can actually use all of the freely available tools in the SDK to compile the bytecode and to assemble the APK file. But honestly, it's going to be much simpler to use the Eclipse IDE because it abstracts all of that away and it makes it much easier for all of us to do. And in fact, it's required for this class that you actually use Eclipse because we are expecting when you submit your projects to us that they are in fact Eclipse projects so that we can actually see your source code in a common way throughout everything. And so in a few weeks when we start talking about Android, you'll see a variation of this, of how we can build an app without using Eclipse, and it has many more steps, and it's a bit more complicated, but luckily using this Eclipse IDE, it becomes something that's a little bit more, it's a little bit easier to chew, I think, compared to before. And so just like with iOS, how there's a simulator that you can simulate a hardware device, there's also a simulator that you can use for Android as well. But of course, it being a software simulation means that there are some limitations to this device that you wouldn't have when using a hardware device. And so some of these honestly are a bit expected, and they're a bit obvious, I think, in terms of the limitations of the emulator. But some of them you might kind of not remember, and you might start to use the emulator and you might kick yourself as you realize, oh my goodness, now all of a sudden there's actually no way that I can try to attach headphones to this, for example. So there's a whole bunch of limitations to the emulator. And so what you will find is that if you become really serious about development for one or both of these platforms, that's generally beneficial. While you certainly can develop entirely using the software emulator, and it's certainly possible to do that, you will find that it's beneficial generally to have hardware devices for these platforms, especially if you get serious about writing applications for each of these and you really want to create and test your applications outside of the emulator, which is always generally a good idea. Now, there's something that's not even mentioned here that we'll get to talk a little bit about today, and that is HTML5 video. So a lot of these devices do support HTML5 video in their web browsers, but the emulator, at least in Android, does not support it as well as you might expect. Now, of course, Android is open source. You've heard about this. This is perhaps one of the major things that differentiates Android from iOS, besides everything else that makes it very different. But it's one of the things that a lot of people like to make arguments about when they're comparing iOS versus Android. It feels very much like the PC and Mac wars of just a few years ago. But as a result of this open source release of Android, or perhaps not a direct causal relation to that, but because it is, in fact, able to be placed on a variety of hardware devices, we do get this concern about fragmentation, about how multiple versions of Android, the Android OS, can be placed onto different hardware. And so we can actually see, this is actually a breakdown of the different versions of Android that Google compiles every 6 months or so and places on their developer page, so that you can see what the latest breakdown of the different versions actually happens to be. And in this case, this was data that was collected just a couple of weeks ago, January 3rd of this year, in fact. And so you can actually see that the vast majority of users, even though Android 4.0, the ice cream sandwich, has come out and is now, the new hot thing that everybody wants to get in on, the vast majority of the people are still using Android 2.2 or Android 2.3. And so a lot of these things are considerations that you have to take into account when developing for Android, and might be, in fact, a little bit different from iOS, where generally people, at least it seems in general, people try to upgrade their iOS devices and use at least a more sane version of this same platform breakdown on the iOS side. So that's something that we'll have to be cognizant of when we're talking about the platform, and we will be talking more about this when we start talking about Android specifically. So, HTML5, though. before we can really start talking about some of the native stuff, it's neat to see what we can do in a very cross-platform way using web apps or using some HTML5. And so because a lot of the browsers among these mobile devices happen to use the same rendering engine, which happens to be WebKit, which is the same thing that you would find in Safari browsers or in Chrome browsers, it becomes very easy, or much easier perhaps, to be able to write cross-platform applications in a web app for all of these devices. So HTML5 is sort of an interesting thing, and in fact, I got to say that when I was doing research for this a few years ago, that I found that there's some HTML5 website where the groups that are working on it decided that they really wanted to market HTML5 as the new hot thing, and so they actually made a whole bunch of icons that look like this. I didn't make icons that look like this. But they actually made icons not only for HTML5, but they also made icons for each of the individual technologies involved with it. And so, thank goodness, I don't have to just have a boring slide that just says HTML5. We can now have a Superman shield that has the number 5 on it instead and make it look even that much more interesting. So basically, you can read about the history of HTML5. It's actually pretty fascinating to see how it evolved over time, why it came up as opposed to XHTML. But basically, XHTML had poor adoption. XHTML2, which was the next thing that people were working on, just was a non-starter. There were a variety of problems, including MIME type problems and everything like that. And so they sort of went back to the drawing board and started realizing that what they wanted to do was to create a new HTML that was going to be, in fact, backwards compatible, which is, of course, very important in the web, because people use all sorts of different devices using all sorts of browsers, and it's important to be able to retain that backwards compatibility. And there's two major groups that work on HTML5. There's the WHATWG, the WHATWG, or the, I can never remember exactly what it is, the Web Hypertext Application Tech Working Group, and also the W3C. They're sort of working together to create the specification for HTML5. But really, it's important to note that when they talk about HTML5, they really want to refer to it just as HTML, because it's very difficult, as you'll find out when we start talking about some of the specific technologies, it's very difficult to snapshot a specific version of HTML5 as this, as some specific set of technologies. And instead, what it is an evolving set of technologies that develop over time. And it's really difficult to say, well, this right now is HTML5, HTML6 is going to have this option and this feature. It's not really something that works very well, just because of all of the vast number of moving parts that are involved in creating this HTML5. So really, it's HTML5 is really just a collection of ideas and features that browsers are slowly implementing individually over time. So some browsers may have limited support for HTML5, and what that might mean is that they might support some things that we're going to be talking about and not others. And so it's really difficult to say that a web browser is HTML5 compatible, because unless it has implemented everything, it becomes a little bit ambiguous. What does that mean? Perhaps it is compatible with some things and not others. So it's really something to be aware of as well. And we'll actually provide some solutions for you to be able to know, for your web application to know what features of HTML5 you can actually use in your application. So basically, the technology that comes with HTML5, and here's more of those icons that I was mentioning before, are broken down into a variety of technologies. So there's So there's actually additional ones as well, but these are sort of the major ones that we're going to be talking about today. Semantics, including the tags, and the CSS3, which of course is used for styling, multimedia like HTML5 video, storage, which is something that we're going to be talking about maybe today, but probably next week when we start actually dealing with some of the nitty-gritty aspects of it. But realize that there are, in fact, some tools, some frameworks, like David had mentioned before, that allow us to make it a little bit easier to deal with some of these technologies. And one of them is this, called Modernizer. And Modernizer is just it's a small JavaScript thing that you can download and implement in your web application to provide a variety of features to your web app. You can query the Modernizer, object and figure out what features the browser actually supports, which HTML5 features the browser actually supports. And I believe it's even a little bit more a little bit more specific than that. You can query what specific types of CSS features it might be able to support and what sort of technologies you can use in your browser. And as you'll find out in just a minute, if you plan to create a web application that would work not only in the mobile space, but also with computers that might be running Internet Explorer, you really are going to be wanting to use something like this to make your life a lot easier when dealing with things like that. So, of course, when we are talking about creating HTML5 or creating HTML pages in general, it's also useful to mention validation. So typically, what you might want to do is to create a web page and make sure that it is actually valid as an HTML page. And so the W3C markup validation service is one thing that you can use for this, but there's also a validator that's specific to HTML5 as well. And there's links that will be available on the course website to each of these validation services. These are just sort of ways that you can double check your work and make sure that things are going to be at least semantically and syntactically correct. Even though it may not appear necessarily correct on every browser, you can at least make sure that the web page that you've created is, in fact, sane in that way as well. So let's talk about some of these specifically. So the semantics. So in HTML5, there are actually quite a few new elements that actually that make things quite a bit nicer for a lot of the types of pages that we actually see out in the internet today. So just to provide an example, and by the way, as you'll find out over the course of the semester, that we have a lot of downloadable code that you can find. And so today we're going to have just a few web pages with sample code that you'll be able to download. That will be available on the course website after this lecture is finished. But just keep in mind that typically you can try looking on the course website to see if it's something that you can look at and follow along as we work through each of these examples. So there is a web page here that we've implemented that actually uses that. It's sort of like an overly simple, hard-coded blog. So we have here a couple of articles, for example, with nothing in particular of interest, but it's really just meant to show this type of page that's very common on the internet, with a couple of articles that perhaps have some timestamps associated with them. They have some titles and some content for each of the articles. And even though there's multiple articles here that may be loosely associated by whatever theme that web page happens to implement, those articles might be considered unique individual objects. And so in HTML, in XHTML, it might be very easy to use a whole bunch of divs, for example, and try to create posts that look like this. Whereas in HTML5, there's actually some specific new tags that have been created just for this purpose. So this might look kind of familiar, where you have divs all over the place and you apply IDs to them, footers, and up there is posts, and then you might have, let's see, do we have any more divs? Well, this isn't as div-heavy as other pages might be, but you can imagine if you've done a lot of work in XHTML that you have just a page that's just riddled with a whole bunch of divs that you are assigning IDs that that might make sense in terms of what the content is actually displaying, but really it seems sort of silly to have all of these different divs for these things that might actually be relatively common in a number of web pages. And in fact, that's one of the things that HTML5 strives to do, is that this page is now implemented using some of the new semantics involved in HTML5, but is not actually using all of these divs, as we'll find out in just a second. So if we take a look at some of the new semantics that are here, for example, we can see some new tags that are just very nice. Articles, for example. There's an article tag, there's a footer tag, there's a header tag. These are only just a small fraction of the number of new tags that are available with HTML5, but it is something that's useful. And keep in mind also, or pay attention also to this tag, the time tag, which actually allows as an attribute a date time where you can specify very easily to some web crawler, for example, what that date and time of that article actually is. You can put it, in a very in a pre-formatted way, in a way that a web crawler would be able to understand. And then you, even though you might have it in that form there, you can actually then use plain text or whatever style of date you actually want outside of the context of that element as well. So adding these extra semantics actually makes it quite a bit nicer to deal with creating a lot of these web pages when we're talking about HTML5 versus XHTML. But there is a gotcha, and that is that, of course, before HTML5, none of these tags existed. So some browsers, like Internet Explorer, actually don't deal with these tags properly, especially older versions of Internet Explorer. The latest version does, in fact, deal with them properly, but the older versions of Internet Explorer would just completely ignore the fact that these tags were there and wouldn't actually allow you to style them using CSS or what have you. And so this is the reason why I recommended Modernizer before. There's something that you have to do to Internet Explorer. You have to notify Internet Explorer that you're going to be using some elements that it's never heard of before you can actually use them. So this is one of the things that you have to do in order to make older versions of Internet Explorer accessible to this new HTML5 language, and that is you have to iterate using some JavaScript over a list of all of these new elements that you might be using and just basically create them. Just tell Internet Explorer that you're going to be using them, and then can you actually go ahead and style each of them. And now, this, of course, is not a complete list of all of the new HTML5 elements that exist. And that's why I recommend using a framework like Modernizer, or you can actually find snippets of code that actually include all of the new HTML5 elements. Then you would just include that JavaScript at the top of your website, or just embed it into your page directly in the script with some script tags, and you'll be able to access then all of these new technologies. So this is a little bit of an annoyance, but it's something to be aware of, and not necessarily, it's not going to be something that's going to be a deal breaker necessarily. Let's see. So, Yes, every page that uses HTML5 elements, you will have to have that snippet of code if you want it to be backwards compatible with older versions of Internet Explorer. If your web page happens to be something that's designed specifically for mobile, most likely you're not going to have to worry about that, because the latest version of Internet Explorer on Windows Phone supports those tags, as do, of course, all of the latest, browsers on Android and iOS going way back. They've supported this now in WebKit for a long, long time. So really, this is that snippet of code that I showed you before. There's a link to that in the code itself. It's only useful if you have backwards compatibility, or if you want backwards compatibility with older versions of Internet Explorer. All right, so moving on from semantics is CSS. So CSS is something, this is sort of another interesting thing that we have to deal with, and that is that there's a lot of new features that come with CSS. There's more specifically the third version, the third iteration of CSS, things that make some really fancy appearing, looking web pages where you can have all sorts of fancy animations and do all sorts of fancy things to the elements on the page itself. But unfortunately, just like with many other things, CSS is not actually fully implemented, or CSS 3 is not fully implemented by all browsers. And in fact, what you might actually find is that there are specific rules to these CSS, or to browsers that support versions of CSS, or the latest version of CSS, that maybe other browsers do not actually support. And we'll show you what that means in just a second. Now, just to get through some of the other ones, so multimedia is sort of an interesting thing. Now in HTML5, there's a video element that can also be used. Now, because we had the ability using this script to enable all of these different types of elements in, for example, older versions of Internet Explorer, doesn't mean that they're actually going to function as you might expect. And most specifically, what we're talking about here is with regard to the video element in HTML5. The video element is meant to just be able to display a video in a very nice way on your web page. And just by enabling it here doesn't mean that it will work on older versions of Internet Explorer. Again, that's only for older versions of Internet Explorer. But there is that new video tag that allows us to do quite a few things with it, to be able to embed video in a web page and show it without having to use Flash, without having to use a Flash object, which is particularly useful for iOS and the versions of Android that do not actually happen to have a Flash player embedded. But there's a couple of important things to realize, and that is that it's usually a good idea to use a framework again for this, because then it enables a number of features that you just wouldn't want to enable yourself, including the play bar along the bottom and some other things. It's just a nice way to implement some of these details without having to do it all by yourself. But there are some important caveats when we're talking about multimedia when it comes to web applications. And that is that, for example, the Android emulator can't actually display web video. So you might you might spend a long time implementing a video element in your web page. You might fire up the Android emulator and take a look at your web page to try to see your own video, and you might find that it doesn't work. Well, this is because the Android emulator itself just doesn't support it. iOS 3.x, so versions of iOS from 3, so now this is a couple of years old, so we don't really have to worry about it unless you really want to be backwards compatible. But there's problems with that involving some of the attributes in the video elements, and I think specifically one of them was the poster element. It would just cause the whole thing to break down, and it wouldn't work at all. Android can't deal with the type attributes. There's just a whole variety of things that you have to pay attention to, and using a framework, again, is a way to abstract away each of these problems and be able to implement something that works in the vast majority of devices that you might actually want to use. Now, in HTML5, like I mentioned before, there's a whole bunch of different things that are related, technologies that are related to HTML5, and most of them actually are implemented through JavaScript. So storage, like we'll see later, graphics, connectivity, device access, performance, these last four are things we're not really going to be talking about specifically with regard to HTML5, as we have a lot of other things to talk about instead. But just keep in mind that these are portions, or these are units of HTML5 that are important to the whole, as of that we were actually talking about before. Now, if you actually want to create an HTML5 page, it's something that you can do relatively easily, just like you've done if you created a web page before. It actually becomes something that's very easy to do with the text editor, frankly. So we have here a variety of sample code, and what we're going to do through this sample code is begin with some basic XHTML. In this case, these pages are actually XHTML, but you can implement an HTML5 very easily, as I'll show you in just a little while. But you can see here we're just using some very basic elements, and what we're going to do is build up some CSS to create a web page that works not only on a desktop machine but also on a mobile device as well. And there's some important considerations when you're designing a web page that can be viewed in both of these contexts. So here we just have a very basic page with some very basic markup. You can just see that we have a couple of paragraphs here, a couple of the body and HTML tags. There's really nothing very fancy going on in this particular page. So if we want to style this, of course, we can use CSS to be able to do it. And if we have something like a desktop browser, then you might actually want to use as much space as provided to you on a desktop. And one of the nice things about desktop browsers is that they tend to be very wide. So you can fit a lot of content in the width of the browser as well. So rather than have all of that text sort of just very, very plainly stacked one on top of the other in a single column, can we style it so we have multiple columns of text? And so, yeah, this is a little bit contrived of an example, but it's really meant to show you that what we can do here is show this text in a variety of different ways effectively on a browser. Now, when we're dealing with CSS, of course, keep in mind some of the discussion that David mentioned earlier in the lecture, and that is regarding if you are creating CSS for a web application, you might want to be aware of the HTTP requests that you're actually placing. But what we're going to do for a variety of these is just to link to each of these CSS files rather than embed them within the web page itself. So here we can see that we have a desktop CSS, and we are just basically styling each of these to create this very simple two-column layout. And so if you want to see the specifics to this, I'll refer you to the source code when it is posted a little bit later on. But if we want to actually create a web page that might be a little bit friendlier for mobile, how would we have to modify this page for that purpose? So first of all, think about what is the primary difference between a mobile device and the desktop device, desktop screen. Yeah.
Screen real estate.
Yeah, screen real estate. So it's much smaller, and generally it's much smaller in which direction? I mean, it's obviously much smaller in both directions, but one of them is stretched a little bit more than the other. And what I'm getting at is that generally when you have a mobile device, it is in fact a bit taller than it is wide. So what you have is a device that's now much smaller, and you have a much taller screen. The aspect ratio has actually been modified so that you have a much taller screen. So generally, having columns like this means that if everything were to be shrunk down to the size of a smartphone, it's going to be really annoying to use, because now you have all of that content on the page, but what do we have to do in order to read this content here on a mobile device? Yeah, we'd have to zoom in to the first column on the left, scroll down, and then we'd have to then perhaps maybe zoom out and then re-zoom in to the column on the right, or we'd have to know to go back up to the upper right-hand corner to be able to read this. And that's sort of an annoying thing to do. And in fact, what would be much better is to present this data, in fact, in a top-down way. So generally, if you have a web page where you have a variety of columns, and one of the first things that you want to do for the adaptation of that web page to the mobile device would be to change all of those multiple columns into a single column layout, just like we have here in Index 2. So now, keep in mind that because we're using CSS to style this code, what we are seeing are the web page itself, the HTML itself, does not actually change except for one small thing, and that is, of course, the reference to the CSS file that we're using here. All of the rest of this code actually remains the same from the desktop version to the CSS version. So we can see here then what the difference is from the mobile version to the desktop version. Basically, we're just calling each of these columns, rather than using them as columns, we're just going to stack one on top of the other. We're just going to remove the CSS references that allow these columns to actually sit adjacent to each other and allow them to just sit one on top of the other. And so this already by itself is going to play a huge role in making the page a bit more readable. So just to prove this point, here is, for example, that original page on a simulated device, on an iOS simulator, and you can see that not only is it shrinking it, but also it's providing some padding on either side to making the web page a specific size. And the reason for this is that if the web browser in an iOS device is not told what width that it should actually be displaying this content in, it's actually going to default to a certain resolution, which I think is around 960 pixels or so in width. And it's going to compute that page. It's going to render that page as if it were being shown on a screen that had a width of about 960 pixels. So what this means is that when it actually compresses that rendered page that it's generated into the very narrow view frame here of this device, we get this result, where we actually see these two columns with text that is completely illegible, and we get this extra padding on the side. But if instead we then use one of these mobile things, and yeah, there's still a little bit of a problem here in that the text is still very small because of this same problem that I mentioned just a minute ago. It's assuming, the device is assuming a width of about 960 or 980 pixels, rendering the page at that width, and then shrinking that rendered page to fit in the display. We're getting this as a result of that. We're now seeing this very small text, but it's a little bit better as a result of us no longer using this two column idea. And that exactly is the idea of the next version. So even though Index 2 looks like this, and so these are both on the desktop browser here, you'll see that if I go directly to Index 3, it actually looks the same on a desktop version. The major difference between this and the other on the simulated version is, in fact, what the page will look like once it is rendered. So here now, we've told the device what width this page should be rendered at, and as a result, it can then render all of this text in appropriate ways. So basically, we can say, okay, this web page should not be rendered at a width of 960, 980 pixels, whatever it is, and then shrunk down to size, which means that all of the text, all of the images are going to be shrunk into some illegible into some illegible size. Instead, what we're saying is use the width of the device, in this case, to be able to generate this layout, to be able to render this page as you would actually expect. And so this code is then doesn't impact the major browser or the browsers on the desktop, but rather what it does is just a small bit of code that we've implemented in the head tag. In this case, it's this meta tag right here that tells the mobile device that we actually want to allow it to render at a width that's going to be appropriate for use on that same device. So here, if we take a look at this, we're setting the viewport. We're telling the browser that the viewport, that we can set the width of that viewport to the width of the device. And so that way, the browser on the mobile device can make its own calculation about what would be an appropriate width for that device, and then work with it from there. And that's really the only difference between each of these two files is the presence of that meta tag. We're still using that same mobile CSS. We haven't changed the mobile CSS as we saw when we saw the two different versions of these on the desktop browser. But in fact, just adding that one simple tag makes it look a lot better on our mobile device. All right, so this, though, is... Oh, yes, there's a question.
Yes. How does the how does the browser know what the device width is?
How does the browser know what the device width is? So on the phones, because it's already on the device, it's very much like how the web browsers, you can access the screen width using JavaScript in the browsers as well. It's just something that the browsers happen to know. It's perhaps passed to it by the operating system, or it's, I'm not sure the exact mechanism through which the browser itself knows, but there is precedence for this in desktop browsers as well, where you can actually access the width of the screen dimensions of the screen itself using JavaScript on a desktop browser as well. And so it's perhaps there might be some API hooks that the browser itself uses in the underlying code to actually query that from the OS. In iOS devices, because we don't expect the screen size to change at all, that might actually be hard-coded. It's unclear the specific reason, but at least there is at least it is provided that data somehow through some mechanism. Any other questions? Yes. So is the device width the same as the window width? So this is not something that's really used by desktop browsers, at least in the same traditional sense. Really, I think this tag is used more by mobile browsers to be able to make that determination in order to figure out what would be the appropriate width for this, so that you don't have to zoom in or out quite as much, because zooming is not something that we actually do on desktop browsers unless it's to make the entire page a little bit smaller or a little bit bigger or what have you. So I don't actually know if there's any browsers that have implemented, desktop browsers at least, that have implemented its use like that. But I would assume that for now that's at least being ignored by a lot of the desktop browsers. Yeah. So BlackBerry's are different because I believe that the web pages, it goes through a proxy, at least the old style. I'm not sure how the newer BlackBerries work. I haven't actually used one in now years. But if it still goes through this idea of a proxy, then the proxy, whatever BlackBerry servers do, they probably change the HTML itself to be appropriate to be viewed on the device. They might have, I imagine now after a few years of market pressures, they probably actually have some browsers that can display the web page in a true fashion without actually having to go through that proxy that alters the HTML or that alters the layout of the web page itself. But I don't really know anything about those browsers, and I wouldn't be able to speak as to how they actually react with the device width. But if it uses WebKit, then most likely it will react in a similar way. Any other questions? All right. So this is fine, all well and good, but really what I want to be able to do is to add some extra CSS flourish. What I want to be able to do is to make this look a little bit sexier, perhaps, and a little bit more web app-y. And so we can actually use some CSS, some fancy CSS rules to be able to add some things like some fancy gradients as the background of these boxes. We can also add some curved corners here, which might add just some nice little touches to our page. And so if you're interested in looking at this, I'll refer you again to the source code. But basically, it uses just some simple CSS rules that you would be able to find that are specific, again, to some web browsers. And in this case, we are using the WebKit specific versions of these CSS rules to be able to implement these niceties. So this would work only on WebKit browsers like Chrome, Safari, the iOS browser, and the Android browser. But it's not going to work in, say, Firefox or Internet Explorer. All of these things will just be ignored by those other browsers. Now, if we really wanted to get fancy, there's a lot of additional stuff that you can do with CSS as well, like skewing these divs, rotating them, combining a skew and a rotation and a translation and a scaling, and you can do all sorts of fun stuff. This is sort of if you really want to do this, you can, but this is really just an example of how to do it. But if you want to alienate all of your users by having all of your text upside down or making it really impossible for them to read without, you know, giving them a kink in their neck, then go for it. But really, this is just to sort of show you the fun stuff that we can do with CSS, more so than like, oh, yeah, now you can do this. Go implement it everywhere in all of your web applications. All right, so getting back to some of the useful things that we might actually do, what if we actually want to do something a little bit smart? What if we don't want to have two separate pages to try to determine which of these CSS style sheets we should display, depending on which what the context of viewing this web page happens to be? So here, for example, and yeah, I made the browser a little bit small here. So this page, index 5, actually then allows us to select which of the CSS versions is going to be appropriate based on the device that we are viewing it on. So this is the same page now viewed on two different contexts. One of them is here, the desktop browser, and one of them is here, the mobile browser. So we can select in a smart way, well, hopefully a smart way, which of these devices is viewing the web page and show then or render the page with the appropriate style sheet. So we can do this in a variety of ways. And in this case, what we are using is, in fact, some simple JavaScript to be able to, oh, not even some JavaScript yet, we're using some CSS selectors to be able to do this. So let's just take a look at what some of this does. And this is one of those things that's a do as I say, not as I do. This is showing you what not to do when implementing this sort of idea, even though it might be tempting because it's kind of easy. So what we have here are a variety of CSS style sheets. And there's a desktop version, as you can see in the top line. There's a mobile version, as you can see in the subsequent lines. And then we have, of course, a block for Internet Explorer in case it ignores all of our previous CSS commands or all of our previous media selectors above. But we can see that the major way that we are selecting which one of these that we actually want to display is using this media attribute in the link element. So in this case, if it is a screen and it has a minimum device width of 481 pixels, which happens to be one pixel larger than the old iPhone screen, then what we're going to do then is show the desktop CSS. Now, if we happen to be on a device that has a maximum width of 480 pixels, then we will show, we are going to assume that it's a mobile device, and then we'll show the mobile CSS instead. But there's kind of an obvious problem to this, and I kind of alluded to it just a second ago. And what is that problem? Yeah, so if the device width changes, this is actually a script, but the media selection actually breaks. So newer iPhones, since the iPhone 4, you have the new fancy Retina display, which means that it's much higher resolution. Newer Android devices have much larger screens and also have much larger resolution. So it's very easy for some of these handheld devices to actually exceed this minimum device width of 481 pixels. So it's actually possible for you to load this page on a mobile device, and you'd be confused because you'd say, well, it's not actually working the way that I expect it to work. Now, sort of a saving grace is this media selector right here. If it's a handheld, then we will actually display the mobile CSS as well. But honestly, this is not very clean. The fact that we have to have all of these different selectors, we basically have four different link tags to display two different CSS style sheets, and it's just not a very clean way of going about this. But this is something that you can do if you have a very specific style sheet for a very specific device width or anything that can be selected with the media tag, and you know that the browser is going to respect that media tag, then you can actually use something like this. So this is something that was sort of an attempt at fixing this problem, but frankly, I don't think it's going to be a very robust solution for most of what you want to be able to do. So instead, maybe we can do something in a different way using Index 6. So this is the very similar thing. If we were to display this same code on the iOS device, we would see that we also are able to select which the proper style sheet for each of these devices. But instead of using media selectors, what we are going to use here is some simple JavaScript to do this. So notice that we have a script tag for JavaScript. And what we are using, the important bit right here, is this if statement. If navigator, which is an object supplied by the web browser, dot user agent, so the web browser presumably knows the user agent string that it's sending to the web server, dot index of is just a method, a JavaScript method that allows you to search for some text in a string, and it will return the position of that text in that string, does not equal -1. So in other words, if that actually returns a position in that string and not -1, which means that that string was not, this iPhone string was not found in the user agent, then what we are going to do is to assume that it is in fact a mobile device, because we've selected either, we found that the user agent either has iPhone or Android in it, and we will display this mobile CSS here. Otherwise, we will be able to link to the desktop CSS. Now, this is going to work a little bit better, but is there a problem with this? Any problems iPads. With this? What's that? iPads might, I actually don't know what their user agent string is, but they might actually say it's an iPhone, but you're on the right track. Other mobile devices, like BlackBerries, for example, are not going to report that it's an iPhone or that it's an Android device, and so you're going to lose out on all of the other mobile devices just based on this fact that you have this very limiting amount of JavaScript. But if, again, you have some specific reason to do this or some specific platforms that you want to target, you could do this. There are other frameworks that you can use to be able to determine if the device is actually a mobile device. It has a much larger database. Some of these frameworks have relatively large databases of various user agent strings that are reported by many mobile devices, and you can use that as a way to accurately, or much more accurately, determine what sort of user agent is actually being used to look at your web page. But there's even a different way that we could do this. So this index 7 is very similar to index 6, except for one thing. Now, instead of using index of, we can also use dot match, the dot match method, which is just a way of setting a regular expression. So perhaps you can create a more complex regular expression to try to determine if the device itself is actually a mobile device. So this is just a slightly different way of accomplishing exactly the same thing with exactly the same pitfalls as the previous version here, but just showing you the sort of variety of ways that you can implement this sort of detection. But perhaps you realize that you actually don't want the mobile, or you actually don't want the browser itself making the determination about which style sheet it should actually display, but maybe instead you want the server to decide whether it should display a desktop or a mobile CSS. And for that, you would actually have to change your code so that it's no longer just a static HTML file, but you might in fact have to implement, in this case, this is a PHP file that's being processed on the server, and the server then decides, based on the user agent string, which CSS style sheet it should actually display to the user. So we can see here, if we take a look at this, at the code, at the HTML that's being sent from the server, so keep in mind that this has been already processed, we no longer see the PHP code that was being used to process this, we can find out that it made the determination, the server decided that we are actually using a desktop browser, and it then sent that desktop CSS file instead of the mobile CSS file. So if we actually wanted to look at the raw code, it's over here. And you don't have to know PHP. Don't worry about it. But you can just, this again is just a different way that we can implement this. There's just some PHP code right here that allows us to search the user agent string for either iPhone or Android. So again, this has the same pitfalls as before. We're only selecting iPhone and Android. But there again is there are some frameworks for PHP that you can download that give you a much larger database, and you can query to make the determination if that device with its given with its stated user agent string happens to be either a mobile device or a desktop device or what have you, and then output the appropriate code here as well. Yes.
Does the extra router provides the user agent, like if it's desktop, then we can just if block user agent is equal to desktop and shows desktop plus CSS is mobile.
So can you repeat the question? I'm sorry. I think.
Desktop.
Yep. So the tricky thing about the user agent string is that all browsers provide it, but you're not guaranteed for it to even be accurate. In a lot of browsers, you can actually change the user agent string even by a menu option. So, for example, in Safari, if you enable the developer menu, you can actually bring a pull down and change the user agent that it's reporting. You can actually have Safari tell the server that it's connecting to that it's, in fact, an Internet Explorer. It's actually very useful if you have one of those stupid sites that works only with Internet Explorer, and they enforce that rigidly, and you know better, so you change it to Internet Explorer, and it works somehow magically. Anyway, so just because it's being provided a user agent string from the web browser doesn't even necessarily mean that it's correct. Just like a lot of the other HTTP. Fields that can be sent, or a lot of the data that can be sent in the headers of HTTP can be forged by some malicious user or just by the web browser itself as it's actually initiating the request. So this is something that you can use as a tool, but it's not going to necessarily be foolproof. A lot of people can actually get around this, especially now that you know of these tricks that you can actually change the user agent string. You could actually change your desktop browser's user agent string to report that it is an iPhone, for example, and then see the mobile version of a lot of these websites if they happen to use a very similar thing here as well. Now, again, a lot of this code, we were talking a little bit more about CSS in this case, but a lot of this code was, in fact, XHTML-driven and not HTML5-driven. So again, I just want to remind you that when you go home, take a look at the HTML5 comparison, that web page that actually displays two different versions of basically the same thing. One implemented in XHTML, if that's what you happen to be familiar with, and how we can adapt that for use in HTML5. And hopefully, if you take a look at the two, you will see that the HTML5 version just makes a little bit more sense. It's a little bit cleaner because of the tags that we can use. It just looks, the code, the markup, somehow, if markup can ever be called clean, the markup actually looks a little bit cleaner because there's not quite so many divs that are littering the page. So take a look at this as well. But for the last few minutes, what I want to show you is, in fact, something that is specific to mobile devices, and that is that there are a number of HTML5 elements that are specific to mobile devices that you can implement in a web page to become very useful. Now, if we implement them, desktop browsers will actually show them in the way that you would expect, but it's not going to work in the same way that you might actually hope. So, for example, here we have a link that allows you to initiate a phone call. We have another link that allows you to initiate a text. You can also send multiple recipients of a text. Now, granted, not all of these work in all devices. Pretty much the initiating a phone call one works pretty much universally in a lot of these devices. The text one, I think sometimes the multiple recipients doesn't work quite as well in all of them, but still something, an option that you have. And I will show this to you also in the mobile, in the iOS simulator as well. But basically, we have here a couple of input fields that allow you to input some text. But depending on some of the attributes that you apply to these input fields, can you actually change the keyboard that is being displayed on the mobile device? So just to show you here some of the examples that are being displayed, let's open up this same page in a mobile device. So here I can ask it to initiate a phone call. Obviously, we can't actually initiate a phone call from a simulator, but if you were to do this on your actual device, it would work just fine. I don't think this will work either. Nope, that's not going to work either. But what I can show you is here. If I click on this and I actually want to type, we can see the standard iOS keyboard actually pops up. But here, let's say that I want to create an email field. I can then hit that, and notice in particular the biggest change is perhaps down here rather than just the raw space bar. We also have the at sign and the period that appear at the bottom there. And this one here is now the URL input field. So these are just very simple ways that we could implement this same thing. And when I say that it's simple, I really do mean that it's as simple as applying some extra attributes to your input fields. So here we can see the standard input type just looks like this. Input type is text. If we want to do email, we could do input type email. Then we can also specify some additional attributes that are specific to iOS in this case. So we don't want autocorrect, for example, because that's really annoying for email. We don't want autocomplete. We don't want auto-capitalize. How many times have you started entering in an email and it starts capitalizing and correcting your email address and just becomes frustrating? You can eliminate all of those frustrations in your web app by implementing these very simple attributes to your input field. Similarly, for URL, can we do the same thing? We just say that it's a URL input type with no autocorrect, no autocomplete, and no autocapitalize. And these attributes, these specific types, these attribute types are actually HTML5, are supported by the HTML5 standard, or you know, that nebulous thing that I mentioned before, the collection of standards that make up HTML5. So web browsers that support HTML5, and at least the semantics portion of HTML5, will be able to properly show, just as this desktop browser did, appropriate input field types depending on the type that you're displaying, and for those devices that actually fully support the ability to show the different types, where you actually get that additional benefit as well. And so if you really want to be obnoxious and you want to prevent people from being able to select some text, so for example, here we can select some text, but here I cannot. Notice that this paragraph I can, and of course you can't see me clicking, but I'm clicking like mad on here, and I'm not actually able to select that text. You can do the same thing here on iOS, where you can try to select some text there, but here, just can't do it. And you can do that by specifying a WebKit-specific CSS rule by saying WebKit user select none. So these are just some ways, some mobile-specific ways that we can actually implement some neat features from HTML5 in a web application that can really make the difference between just a generic web application and something that's useful. And so just to show you, because I didn't show you before, how we can actually create a link that will actually be able to call somebody, all you have to do is create a standard link, but rather than use something like email colon, for example, you can actually specify that it's a telephone number or that it's an SMS. And the device, the mobile device in particular, should know what this means. Now, desktop browsers pretty much have zero support for this, but maybe if you were really fancy, you could be able to implement some way of hooking into the web browser and initiating a call using some SIP telephony service or something like that. But you know, for pretty much 99% of the time, or even more than that, 100% of the time, is this link not going to work on a desktop, but it will, in fact, on a mobile device. And so with that, thank you all very much for coming to Lecture Zero. We will see you next week when we continue talking about web applications. We really start diving into some of the fun stuff of HTML5. See you then.